You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
You are now listening to the Ride or Cry podcast.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Good day, sir.
Long time no see.
Wonderful to see you again.
As always.
I was thinking about our conversation all day yesterday and how nice
were
it
you?
Was. Yeah, it was just nice to talk to you. It's nice to talk to people that you like every once in a while instead of just being on conference calls and shit. It's just good.
I couldn't agree more, dude.
So
that's true.
Thanks for doing it, and thanks for having me for this.
Of course. It'd be funny, Morgan, if you also interviewed Travis for K-Rock this week, and then it was just...
Dude, it's a trifecta. It's the fucking...
We're going to run out of questions after this one.
I talk a lot.
I was telling Babs yesterday that the last 2 days, all I've done, I was honestly afraid my voice was going to be sore today because all I've been doing is talking.
That's all I do, dude. And I started streaming and shit too. So I just like fucking yell on stream and yeah, it's a good time.
Yeah. We just had a conference call with someone who had never been on a conference call.
That's cool.
First time.
I was like, what the fuck? What is that like?
First time they've ever had a conference call.
Yeah.
Were they 10 or like what?
They were just born yesterday.
Yeah.
So weird. Okay, let's jump into it. Let's get serious. You guys ready to get serious? Cool. Okay, so a couple of things I feel like that we're going to talk about, we talked about yesterday, but it's okay because
it's all good.
Fuck it.
Content is evergreen.
Yeah. Not me. So I'm going to elaborate on the story I told you yesterday about the first time that I found out about you and your music. I was in college and we were there was this program for Sony Music where there was like a college rep in every city and they would fly us out to New York every October for CMJ and watch a bunch of showcases. And I remember like most of them were really boring, but yours was just so fun. I feel like your performance was just so like... I don't know. I feel like everybody after that was like, let's hit the town. Like, let's get fucked up and like, let's party, you know? And I remember that night we like hailed a limo on the street instead of
a cab. Oh my God, what did I inspire?
We were trying to hail a cab and then a limo pulled up and we're like, yeah, let's do it. We got in a limo. We went to some party. We stayed out all night. And I honestly feel like your performance and your music just inspired us to just live large in New York. And it was so that fun.
That is the greatest compliment I could have ever received.
Well, I feel like that's kind of who you are as a person too. I feel like you just have a good energy about you. Anytime you've DJed Emo Night or, you know, any, like all your music videos and everything, there's like a fun vibe, which is...
Thank you so much. It's the complete opposite as to how I am in real life. I just want you to know. I walk around with a cloud over my head and I'm, you know, just drab and boring. So it's all an act. No, I'm just kidding. I try to have, I don't know. I feel like I'm a pretty optimistic person and, you know, I tend to look on the brighter side, you know, of life. And I just want to inspire people. And I always want, like, no matter what I've done, I always want people to leave, like whether it's my Apple Music show, whether it's my podcast, whether it's, you know, a meet and greet or a concert, like I always want people to leave feeling better than when they walked in, you know, And, you know, I've never, you know, look, I like with my Apple Music show, I have access to like the coolest artists in the world. Right. And I feel like a lot of times, like they go into these quote unquote interviews, and people are trying to get like clickbaity headlines. And, you know, if they're in the press for, you know, a breakup or a feud or, you know, something that they did wrong, like people will kind of pry into that. And I've never wanted to be that kind of person. Like, I've never wanted to benefit off of somebody else's struggle or pain. And so I think that that really like has gone a long way for me as well. And like, that's why, you know, people want to come back on my show, or, you know, people want to work with me, or I'm able to build relationships like I have, you know, with y'all. And I don't, I mean, how many emo nights have I DJed now? Like at least six, right? Like at least.
And different cities too.
Yeah. We've done the whole, we've run the whole racket. We've done the tour. And what's crazy is, I think the last place I traveled to was New York in before the pandemic. And I was about to start filming season two of my MTV show. So I was going to be filming in New York. You guys were having the concert, the emo night. Was it Brooklyn? Oh, it was Webster Hall.
Webster, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And I did Webster Hall in November, like in 2019. And then you guys were going to do it again in February. And you're like, hey, do you want to do this? And I was like, of course, I'm going to be in New York anyway. So it was like Friday I was filming. Saturday morning I was filming, and then Saturday night I was going to go do emo night. Well, I landed in New York and I like went through hair and makeup. I like did like a red eye flight, and at like 9 a.m. as soon as I get done with hair and makeup, they call a production meeting and they're like, hey, everything is shut down and, you know, we got to get you on a plane back home. And I was like, well, hold on. I might stay in New York if emo night's still going to go on. And then you guys were like, I think we're going to have to shut it down. And that was like literally my last trip out of LA this whole year.
Yeah. Morgan and I were supposed to go, and we, everything was changing hour by hour. There was a point where I decided I wasn't flying, but Morgan was still planning on going, and we were just watching the news and they were like, no events over 500, no events over 250. And then we decided, okay, in 4 days, it's obviously going to be no shows at all. So we just didn't go, but that was going to be our last show, I suppose, before everything.
Well, and then we had Hawaii right after that. And we were like, I was like, I'm going to Hawaii. And just no, it just, everything shut down right that week. It was very, very strange.
Yeah, Morgan, you were in denial. You were like, I am going. I don't care if I get stuck there. I don't care.
Yeah, I was like, I'll spend whatever.
Yeah. But yeah, I also wanted to ask you about just sort of the beginning of your career. I know it kind of all started through MySpace and getting traction there. And then I think your whole story about going on Warped Tour, but not even as a booked artist, but just kind of hustling, is all interesting. So will you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. I mean, my musical journey began in sixth grade at a school talent show where I put together three of my friends and we played Ramones covers and I think a Clash song. And that was like my first time on stage. I was so nervous, and I learned really fast that I couldn't play guitar and sing on stage at the same time when I was like really shy and in my head. It was probably like my worst performance ever.
Well, granted, it was your first.
Yeah. Technically my first was, I wrote my first song when I was five. And I played it at my grandmother was getting remarried when I was five, and I performed it at her wedding.
Their video? Do you have video of that?
She does have a video. I always bug her and like try to find it, but we just got to like sit through a bunch of family tapes. But I will find it one day, and I will release it. You know, as like maybe like an MTV unplugged. You know, of me at five. So technically, the sixth grade talent show was my second live performance ever. But after that, you know, I just like kept playing in bands, and you know, had a couple pop punk bands that we toured locally. And after we broke up, I was like 17 or 18, and I was always the youngest one in the band for some reason. And that band broke up because everyone else had DUIs. Everyone was older than me, so I was like 16, 17, driving all of us to shows.
Was I?
And I was. Yeah. I don't recall. But okay. People never showed up to practice, so you could have been, and I wouldn't have known the difference. But I was always the most motivated one in the band. And so when I turned like 17, I got really over it, and I got a MacBook for my birthday, and it had GarageBand on there. And I was like, you know, like, I'm done relying on people. I want to be able to make music on my own terms. And so I started learning how to record myself on GarageBand, and I didn't even have a microphone. Like, I would literally hold my laptop and sing into it. And so, you know, I had a MySpace page, but when I was like 19, I think it was like 18. I made a MySpace page for my music, and I was just literally like ripping like random instrumentals off of YouTube, or, you know, off the internet, and recording these weird, awful songs over them. And then I made a MySpace page and started posting them up, and people started listening to them. Like, it was kind of surreal, because I was doing it in literally my closet. In 2009, I had maybe like four songs online, but a friend of mine had a merch company. He had like a little clothing company, and he wanted to go on Warped Tour and sell his clothes. And he was like, "Hey, do you want to come and work the merch booth? And I can't pay you, but I'll buy you a bunk spot on this band Attack Attack's tour bus." And I was like, "Okay." And I was like, "You know what? This could be perfect." And he was like, "If you work my merch booth, I'll let you play like a 15-minute set every day inside of our merch tent." And I was like, okay, I had a PA system. And so every day I'd wake up at like 6 or 7 in the morning. I'd go and get our tent spot. I'd set it up. I'd work the merch booth until about like 2 or 3 PM. And then I'd go to the, you know, to the bus, I'd get my PA system. I'd set it up in the merch booth. I'd go and get my laptop. I'd plug it in. I'd get my mic. I'd play a 15-minute set to like 6 to 10 people. And then I'd break it down, bring it back, and then work the merch booth the rest of the day. And, you know, at night I had my laptop, and I would literally burn 200 CDs every single night, and I would sign all of them. I had like no album artwork to put on them. It was literally like handwritten CDs. And so in the mornings, you know, after I set up the merch tent and got us a tent spot, I would just walk the line, and I had a CD player with headphones, and I'd go around to people and, you know, try to sell them these CDs that I had for $5. And that's literally like how I afforded to eat every day. And, you know, I think like 3 weeks into the tour, I made enough money to print my own t-shirts. And so I printed like 100 t-shirts, and, you know, during my live performances, I could sell them like at the merch booth. And I did that. That was 2009. But what was really cool is that I got to meet these people that were listening to my music on MySpace, and I got to actually put faces to the screen names, and they got to meet me and see that I was a real person. And so, you know, that was cool. Nothing insane happened. But after that tour, you know, I built a solid fan base. And when I got home, a friend of mine who was like a video director, he had called me, and he was like, "Hey, I just finished shooting this music video for this artist. I have all of the gear that I don't have to return until tomorrow." And he was like, "Do you want to shoot a music video?" And I was like, "Dude, I don't even have like a song to shoot a music video for." But I had one song that wasn't done yet. It was like a demo of a song, and I didn't like it. I hated it. I hated the record. And I didn't think I was ever going to put it out, but I was like, this will be good practice for when I do have a record that, you know, I want to shoot a music video for. So I was like, yeah. So the budget was $100, and that $100 budget went to buying alcohol for the video. Cause I need, you know, you need props. You need props at a video.
That's the same budget for videos now.
Now, exactly. Not that far off.
No.
And so I spent $100 on alcohol, and I just called like all of my friends. I called every girl I knew and had them go to my director friend's literal one bedroom apartment. And we shot a music video in there, and it's for the song called Stupid Boy.
I was going to say.
And, okay. And yeah, what's crazy. So we get the video back. I'm like, okay, cool. My first music video. I hate the song though. It's never going to come out. And during that time, a friend of mine had like a metal, very like metal record label. They did like death metal bands and metal bands. And, I was like literally crashing on his couch. I had nowhere to live, and I was sleeping on his couch. And they were like, "Hey, we'll give you $1,000 if you let us put out, an EP or an album." And I was like, $1,000? I was like, yes. And just signed it. I didn't have a lawyer. I didn't have a manager. I didn't have anything. And, lo and behold, what they actually ended up doing is they went behind my back and they hit up my friend who was a director to get all the footage back from that music video. And I'm not kidding. I literally woke up one day and on the front page of MySpace with Fuse, they released that song and that music video. Like the song wasn't mixed. It wasn't mastered. It was like literally the demo. And I was furious, but I clicked refresh and it had like 150,000 views the first day. And I'm not kidding. Like the very next day I had every single major record label calling. And then I got flown out to New York and, you know, I was being, you know, dinners in Beverly Hills and, you know, I mean, like straight out of a movie, you know, like, hey, we're going to send a car service for you and all this stuff. And, yeah, after a couple months of that and like kind of figuring out like, oh, fuck, this is a real thing. I ended up getting a lawyer and a real manager and, you know, signing a record deal with Columbia Records, which, you know, turned into how I met you at the, you know, the college thing. 'Cause you were working for Sony and life hasn't been the same since.
That's your so life cool. Got flipped, turned upside down
in the blink of an eye.
Is there a lesson in that? Like you didn't want to release that because it wasn't perfect, but then it ended up just changing your life? Or is it just,
I think the thing to note is like, sometimes you're not always right. Because in my head, I hated that record. And look, as many people that liked it, like there was equally as many people that hated it. And, you know, I'd get death threats and say like, I was like ruining music and, you know, all this stuff. And I used to take that stuff really personally. And, you know, fun fact is like, I've never once played that song live.
Really?
Not once. My whole career. I never played that song live. And that was my kind of like, fuck you to like, I wasn't friends with my, you know, my friend who I signed that record deal to, by the way, like a couple weeks after that, because once the major labels started coming in and I got a manager and I got a lawyer, I actually found out what was in that contract. And, you know, like, look, I got screwed, but you know, I like to say like, I met all the wrong people in my career first, right? Like everything bad that could have happened to me in terms of like contracts and deals and friends backstabbing me and stuff like that, that happened to me at the very beginning. So kind of moving on from that, there wasn't much like worse, like there wasn't anything like really worse that could have happened to me. So it really kept things in perspective. But yeah, you know, and sometimes in my career, like the songs that I were like, oh, this is it. People are going to freak out over this. This is the song. This is it. You know, this is the single, dead wrong. And oftentimes the songs that I don't like, that I'm like, this is trash. No one's going to like this. Those are the records that go on to, you know, change your life or, you know.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. Like, I know you guys know too, like I'll talk to bands all the time and I'm like, yo, my favorite song that you've ever done is this song. Like, God, I hate that song.
Yeah.
Dude, I mean, it's the same thing with us. Like sometimes we'll release a piece of merch and we'll be like, this is going to do so well. This is going to just kill it. Nothing. And then the things we're like, this is just, goes so hard. It just goes to show that I guess we don't know best. We just don't know what is best for us sometimes. And it's really cool that it ended up that way. I've got radio question stuff for you, which is, you know, I don't want to just, first off, I wanted to just ask you what it is like to be all of my ex-girlfriend's favorite person. almost every single one of them. It's an honest question because you're really one of those people that people gravitate to regardless of what you're doing, especially the women that I'm dating really, really like you. And are you aware of that? And did you ever think of yourself as a person with that likable quality? And like, honestly, you can be honest because I think of myself as half of the time. I'm like, I'm a likable person. I like myself. And then the other half of me goes, you're the worst person. How does anybody like you? Why would they find you relatable? Why would they want you to talk about anything with anybody?
That's definitely me. I think for so long, I think this is the first year of my life where I've ever actually had any kind of self-esteem. And I know that when I tell people that, they're kind of like, really? Because there's two things, right? I feel like there's two categories that I'm stereotyped into before people even meet me. One, people think I'm going to be a fucking complete asshole. Right? They're like, oh, this guy's going to be a fucking douchebag. And I really embrace that. Like, mm-hmm. I don't judge anyone for thinking that. Like, that's just the way that it is. Like, I'm totally cool with it. And, you know, hopefully, you know, if someone actually meets me and has a conversation that, you know, I can not prove them wrong, but yeah, maybe prove them wrong. I don't take that personally. But I think for so long, I had that same thing where I'm like, you know, I'm not good enough. Why does anyone like me? Who, you know, I don't deserve these things. And I feel like it's a bit of imposter syndrome as well. Like, I definitely struggle with that. But no, I've never really thought of myself as someone, I don't know, like I don't think I'm fucking awesome all the time. You know, I don't think I'm cool all the time. I think the opposite. Like, I think I'm clumsy and I think I'm, you know, not a good singer. And I think I'm, you know, there's so many other people that look way cooler than me. But, you know, I think at the same time, it's kept me humble and it's allowed me to like create good relationships in my life. Cause like, I would hate to be that guy. It's kept like my ego suppressed and definitely in check, you know? And I'm like extremely self-aware. So like, if I'm not good at something, I'll be the first one to tell myself that. You know, and sometimes it's detrimental to like my mental health, because, you know, I've come to realize that, yo, I am really good at certain things. And, you know, I do deserve certain things in my life and I deserve love. And, you know, I am a good person. But for so long, you know, I didn't have that kind of perspective about myself or that self-esteem. And it's taken me a long time, a lot of therapy and doing esteemable acts to build that up.
I mean, we also live in the worst city in the world to have a good self-esteem. You know, I live in West Hollywood and I walk outside and within two blocks of walking, I think, wow, I should get a lot of plastic surgery, you know, or I should, I don't know. Everyone is just like perfect here. And if you're not, then you compare yourself to those people. And I think this is the biggest city in the world where that is the case. You know, whenever I go back for the holidays to Hungary, it's like no one's wearing makeup. No one gives a fuck about what they look like for the most part. And it's so refreshing to step outside of being here and realize that this is sort of saturated to this city for the most part, I think.
Yeah, comparison is the thief of joy. You know, like if you want to get bummed out, just go on Instagram and compare yourself to somebody and 100% of the time it works every time.
Oh, you can make yourself sad if you really want to. If you want, you can even make yourself sad by just going through people's Venmo transactions. Like if you really want to make yourself sad, you can definitely do it. I do want to touch on what Babs and you just said is that the comparison thing is just in the last year or two. I stopped comparing myself to anybody else and started comparing myself to me.
How are you doing that?
If I did better today than I did yesterday, then if I change something in a more positive way where I try a little bit harder at one thing that I didn't do yesterday, I compare myself to me and then it makes me feel a little bit better. And it sounds like Travis, that's, you know, kind of the path that you've been taking in the last couple of years as well.
Yeah, 100%, man. And, you know, look, I think a lot of my old music, right, it came from a place of arrogance rather than confidence. And that was definitely like a mask that, you know, I used to like cover up that pain or like that, you know, that self-doubt. And, you know, when I started really working on myself, I didn't really want to play those songs anymore because it like reminded me, like, it's crazy. Cause like when I got signed and like started touring the world and like my career like took off and I was doing all these things that I dreamed about since I was a little kid that I never thought was going to happen. Like, that was the most depressed and angry I've ever been. Like, I did not like the person that I was. Which does make sense, because, like, you know, you think like, oh, if I only had all of these things, if I only, you know, reach this level of success, if I could only do this, I would be happy. My life would be perfect. If I could make this much money, I'm going to be stoked. And then, you know, you get those things and like you wake up and you're still not fulfilled.
That's weird that it works like that, right?
It's so weird. And so it was like, there was, you know, I think 2016 too was like definitely the hardest year of my life, because I hadn't toured. I put music on hold because like I created this television show that I knew was going to sell, and I took it all over, you know, Hollywood and pitched it to like everyone, Netflix and, you know, Apple and Spotify and Snapchat and VH1 and MTV. And, you know, I put all my eggs in this basket and it didn't sell. And, you know, I wasn't touring. I kind of didn't want to release music, and everything kind of crashed, you know? And so I had to kind of rebuild everything and start over. And like, it was definitely like the hardest thing of my life, because I had so much of my identity and so much of my ego was wrapped into being this successful artist, right? Like, I didn't want to do my Apple Music show at first because I don't want people to think of me as a radio host or a podcaster. I want to be a successful artist. I have all these friends that I grew up touring with that are, you know, having number one singles and, you know, going on sold out arena tours. And like, why am I not doing that? Like, I don't, you know, I need to be a successful artist. That's what everyone needs to see me as. And when I abandoned all of that and let it all go, so like my life changed for the better in so many different ways. And like, if you would have told me, you know, 10 years ago that I would be doing what I'm doing now, I would have probably called you crazy. And, you know, I got to kind of restructure not only my career, but like my life. And like, it's so much more fulfilling, and there's so many more like amazing opportunities that came to me because I let go of my ego. Right. And now like I'm able to have this a couple amazing shows with Apple Music. Like I have the Apple logo tattooed in the palm of my hand.
Damn.
Like I'm a fanboy, you know, and like I can go to, like, I went to dinner with Tim Cook, you know, and like just do all of these cool things because I abandoned my ego. And then, you know, now this like new, you know, this new journey and chapter of my life, like for my music and starting a band with my friend Nick called Girlfriends. Like, I feel like I've written the best songs I ever have in my entire life. And I'm the most proud of this new music that I've ever been. And I would have never been able to do that without the, you know, the last 5 years of like writing thousands of songs that didn't come out and doing sessions and like writing albums for other artists that like, it was so bittersweet. Like I've written music for people, obviously that wasn't myself, that when it gets released, it sells millions of albums and their careers take off and, you know, they're going on these world tours and it's cool because it's like, oh, I produced that. Oh, I wrote that. Like, you know, but like, why didn't I do that for me? You know,
dude, I have a question about your writing process, because I'm known to dabble in writing songs. And I found that like writing songs in a studio is like when you have to sit down and actually write a song as a job, to me, at least, felt very strange and unnatural. And like when you do all of your writing, do you sit down with the intention to write a song, or are you just like in a grocery store and you hum something and you're like, fuck, I got to record that, and you do it on your phone? How did you do, what was the process like for this new project?
For the Girlfriends record, honestly, okay, this is going to sound like corny, but like, I feel like I'm always writing, you know, like I'll be laying in bed watching TV and like something will be said that I'm like, oh my God, that I can turn this into a lyric. And mm-hmm. like my notes app on my phone is like my most used app. Like it's
it is my fucking most used app, dude.
Yeah. So I will like literally just have thousands of notes. And so when I walk into a studio, I have these things that I didn't necessarily write in there, but you know, I can pull them out and actually structure them. So like, yeah, like the name Girlfriends, like for our band, like I was driving when I thought of that, and I wrote it down and I was like, cool. And I wrote down like five other band names. And when, you know, Nick and I sat down like in December of last year and we're like, you know, what do we want to call this thing? that was number one at the top of the list. And so I said, I got a couple band names, like the first one's Girlfriends. And he's like, that's it. And I was like, do you want to hear the other ones? He's like, no. He's like, that's it. And that just came with me sitting in traffic, you know, and being like, well, what's a weird, if I go on stage in Arizona, like, what's the weirdest thing I could say? Like, yo, what's up, Arizona? We're girlfriends. And I was like, oh, that's fucking cool. You know?
Yeah. Dude, there's nothing harder than coming up with a band name.
It's so hard.
To this day, there is literally nothing harder. If you've never had to do it and you have to do it, it is absolutely so tasking and you'll go back and forth. But like you said, when you know it and it feels right.
Or like we named Ride or Cry our other company, we just couldn't come up with a name, so we just called it that because we already had a sweater that said Ride or Cry. So we're like, we already have the merch, so we'll just call our company that. Which yeah, I feel
going
like
from
maybe it wasn't
going
the best
from having
idea.
A Ride or Cry. No, I think that's great.
To like, I don't know, to email with like some like labels and you know, sometimes when we're talking to 60 something year olds at labels and stuff, they're like, Ride or Cry? What does that mean? But yeah, it's cool nonetheless for sure.
I mean, going from being like a solo artist to having a band, like solo artist for 10 years, then having to think of a band name is it's a challenging feat, you know?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, you know, it's are like obviously a weird time to put out music because you can't go out and play shows. But on top of that, I think back to when you started and you were at Warped Tour and you didn't even really have a set. You had like this 15 minute kind of a set.
In grass.
Yeah. And all that was at that time was MySpace, right? And now there are so many social media platforms and you have to be active on all of them to reach as many people as you can. So how are you dealing with that? Like, how are you sort of trying to make sure you're on all these platforms and do everything in a way that you know, makes sense and translates?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was definitely a conversation of like, is this a good time to put things out or, you know, do we wait? And then it's kind of like, look, we've had this album's been done and it's like, if not now, then when? Like, if I wait till next year, those songs are going to be old, you know? And if anything, it's like, put this music out. It's crazy because like, we're really building this from the ground up again. It's like starting all over. And that's what's so fun for me. It's like, I get the same feeling.
It feels like that. It's cool because when you look at it and when you listen to it and you see what you guys are doing, it does feel like that. It feels like you're excited and starting a new thing that you guys are both very excited about.
Yeah. And all the branding of it looks really cool. It all looks really cohesive and well thought out.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's cool because like, I get to take all of the experience, you know, that I've had, you know, in the last 10 years and Nick as well, and put it into like a new project. And it, you know, I get the same feelings as like, as I did when I started my solo project. Right. Like, but at the same time, like I have to manage my expectations. Cause I'm like, oh, this song, all right, we just put a song out. Why isn't it at a million streams yet? And it's like, okay, it's a new band. We're, you know, this is like our baby. Like we have to like, you know, so keeping things in perspective is definitely, it's definitely a task, but that's what makes it so exciting because like I get to build this thing from the ground up. And like I said, it's like, if we don't put this album out now, like, well, when, you know? And if anything, like we want this record to come out. It sucks that we're not going to be able to tour and play these songs live, but like we're already in the studio working on a second one. So, you know, it's just like more music's going to come out of this. Like what's the harm in that?
Totally. So the album comes out later this month. Yeah.
October 23rd.
Amazing. Okay, so, what is the most ideal situation that a fan can listen to this? So like time of day, or is a candle lit? Like, should they listen to it on headphones? Should they be driving? What's like the most ideal situation?
I've listened to this entire album while I was driving. I went to Las Vegas a few weeks ago and I found myself like going over 100 miles an hour. I feel like it's
don't
definitely
do that at home, kids.
Yeah. Don't, I definitely think it what it does, like when I listen to it, is it takes me back to like sneaking out when I was 16 years old, like buying a pack of cigarettes and like driving like just around Riverside, California, where I grew up, and just like doing absolutely nothing with people that you love. You know, it feels nostalgic and young while at the same time, like coming from a perspective of somebody who's been through shit. And I feel like it's the most honest and vulnerable I've ever been through my music. And like I said, I'm really, really proud of these songs. And I don't know. It's, you know, there's certain songs on there that are loud and fast and aggressive. And then there's songs that are like dialed back and a little more, what's the word? A little more like contemplative, like, you know, and what I'm really proud of is all of the lyrics. Like, I feel like the lyrics are really, really fucking cool, the way that we've been able to kind of connect everything together. And it's not like a concept album at all, but I think it really like talks about, you know, everything that I've been through and everything that I hope I can find, you know, from what's to come in life.
I think that is a really great way to describe the songs that you've put out so far, is driving around in a car with your friends doing absolutely nothing. I think that anybody that has ever done that will understand exactly what this sounds like. It's a really, really, really great way to describe how something sounds. And I've never really put those two things together, because it's such a unique experience doing that when you are growing up, when there was nothing to do, when you're just discovering music, when you are just hanging out with your friends to hang out with your friends, when we didn't have fucking phones, you know, and we didn't have anything. I think that's a really, really beautiful way to put it.
Thanks, man.
I wanted to ask you, this is for me, that really is just when you're prepping for interviews on the radio. I think this is a weird art thing that whenever I tell anybody that I, you know, one of my jobs is to talk to people and to be on the radio, that a lot of people are really taken aback, because they're like, how can you just talk all of the time about whatever? And it's just it's a weird quality that I've always, I think it's a weird thing that some people like it, some people don't understand it, some people just like listening to it, and some people just don't get it. But when you have to interview an artist that you don't know personally, or when you don't know too much about them, what's your process like doing that? What's your research? Because I mean, it's super easy to interview people that we're friends with, that you know. And yeah. Sometimes it's a little, you know, almost sometimes it's harder, but yeah, it's mainly easier because you can just be like, what the fuck's up? But when you don't know an artist and don't know too much about an artist's past or what they have coming out, how do you do your research for that? How do you come up with the questions for something that you're not as familiar with as let's say somebody you are?
Yeah. I mean, look, at the end of the day, I never want my interviews to feel like interviews, right? Like, and while I'll have like bullet points of like where I think the conversation should go, I'm completely fine with abandoning them at all, like at any time. I think the thing that's helped me the most is like to ask good questions, you have to be a good listener. Right? Because if you're just focused on your next question, you're going to miss sometimes the gems that come out of people's mouth when they're answering a question. So, you know, if it's like, I'll give you an example. Like, I'd never met Kevin Gates before. Okay. I was very nervous because he has a reputation for sometimes being, you know, just iffy in interviews, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to go one or two ways. He's either going to like love it or he's going to walk out. But I knew that he liked, John Mayer. Okay. Which is kind of crazy because Kevin Gates is like, you know, some would call him a gangster rapper. He's a rapper. So I did something pretty ballsy when we started the interview. I just started playing Your Body is a Wonderland. And literally him and I sang John Mayer, Your Body is a Wonderland, the whole entire song. And when that song stopped, he's like, you know why I love that song? I was like, why? He's like, I would listen to that song when I was doing push-ups in prison. And I was like, how many push-ups a day would you? And so that conversation, you know, and then right. I played a Taylor Swift song. He sang every word. He's like, Taylor Swift reminds me of a Nicholas Sparks novel. And I was like, well, how do you feel about the movies? You know? And he's like, I think they're beautiful. And then I played a Panic at the Disco song and we sang along to I Write Sins Not Tragedies. And, you know, at the end of the interview, he took his glasses off and he's like, Travis, I fuck with you. And I was like, dude, I fuck with you too. And he's like, I'm going to give you my personal phone number. And he's like, I don't do this. And I was like, okay. And he's like, look at me in the eyes. He's like, I fuck with you. And dude, that's like how we met. We have a great relationship. And like every time I talk to him, you know, like I just did, he had a record coming out 2 months ago through quarantine. And so I FaceTimed him and, you know, I was going to talk about the record, but he ended up moving somewhere and starting his own farm. And
what?
Yeah. Yeah. He started his own farm. And, you know, halfway through the interview, he's like, look, my daughter's is catching a fish right now, like, you know, with her hands. And so we just talked about fishing and like catfish and how he wants to build tree houses that are studios on his, like, you know, acres of property, and like didn't even really talk about the songs. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that's so much more enjoyable for everyone listening who is a fan of Kevin Gates or who might not be a fan, who then is like, wow, this guy has so many other sides to him rather than just being a rapper. And I don't think that would have happened if I was like, hey, man, who produced this song? Hey, what were you said this in the verse? What did you mean by that? Hey, you have beef with this person. Why do you not like them? You know what I mean? Like it's just so much. I don't know.
Dude, have you ever gone into because there are days where I'm like, fuck, dude, I don't want to talk to anybody. And, you know, since it's your job and now it's my job and Babs's job to do this. Are there days where you just, how do you force yourself to get into that headspace? Do you just sit down and you do it? Or you just, is there something you do to prepare? Because there's, you know, I just sit down and I'm go, all right, this is my thing right now. I'm going to turn it on right now. And then as soon as this is done, I can turn it off. But it is hard to get into that headspace sometimes. So I'm always wondering for people who do this as their career, especially if you do it every single day, like, are there days where you're just like, fuck, how am I going to do this? How do I get through it?
I think I try to be as open-minded as possible. And something that's really helped me is like, I will match whatever energy is being given to me. So if someone comes in and they feel like they don't want to talk, like, okay, like I'm not going to be like, dude, so your song is doing amazing. You know, what is going on? Mm-hmm. It's more like, how you doing, man? You know, mm-hmm. You seem a little out of it. Were you in the studio late last night? You know, have you been doing, how long you've been doing those late nights? Like, you know, what helps me is a cup of coffee. I got one right here. Do you like coffee? You know, oh, what's your favorite drink from Starbucks? Dude, I love that. Remember last year when they had the pumpkin spice lattes and I'm a basic white girl and I drink those all the time, you know? And so like just trying to match energies like really helps me. So I feel I don't ever want to come off as like inauthentic or like not myself.
Yeah, I mean, I also feel like if someone's in a bad mood, you could literally talk about it. I think that's interesting. I think fans want to see artists in a real mindset, a real environment, and I think it's cool to talk about that. It leads to talking about, you know, mental wellness and how everyone's super relatable, regardless of whether you sing in arenas or you know, work at Starbucks. Like, it's everyone goes through the same shit, and I think it's really cool to see that.
Yeah, I think also like not taking it personal, you know, and like a lot of times, like, look, these like people that we're having on our shows and like doing this, you know, like a press day sucks, dude. Like, I've done it like 30 interviews back to back to back to back answering the same four fucking questions sucks. Yeah. So it's like if I could be that one dude that doesn't ask you anything at all about the record and, you know, tells you like, dude, that's a sick shirt, dude. I got the same one like in my closet. Where'd you get yours from? Oh, dope. Yeah, he's flying me out there. This, you know, and just have a fucking conversation. Like, they're gonna be like, that was my favorite interview I've done today. next time, only book me with Travis or only book me with Morgan.
Is this you hinting that we shouldn't have asked you about your music?
No, no, not at all. Not at all.
Dude, when you first started, did you get a lot of pushback from, because I mean, there are companies that you work for pretty fucking big, right? And I know that they want, a lot of bigger companies are like, we really want to hear about the release. We really want to hear about this and this and this and these points specifically. Did you ever get any pushback on being too personal?
No, I think that's one thing that really separates my show from the other shows that are on Apple Music. You know, I feel like everyone, I don't ever just want to like be another music show. I feel like there's a lot of shows on there that are like very high music IQ. So it's like, what guitar tone did you use on this record? And like, you know, when, who mixed it and like what presets did they use on your mic preamp? And you know, like, why'd you decide to use the tone from Abbey Road? And like, fuck all of that, dude. Like, I don't care about that. Like, I want to know, you know, like what you had for breakfast this morning and like, you know, why you're staying in an Airbnb in Atlanta, Georgia. Like, and I think that's like why my show has, you know, I've had 1,000 guests in 2 years. And it just like keeps getting better and better, you know? And that's because like, I don't want to copy anyone else. I feel like my show is a pop culture show. It's not just a music show. And I've always kind of tried to, the thing I get pushback for is like trying to have different guests, right? Like not just musicians or bands, like actors, athletes, entrepreneurs, authors, YouTubers, like really trying to diversify the people that I talk to, because anyone who has like an impact on pop culture, I want them on, like you guys have been on my show.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, that was so fun to me because, you know, you guys aren't like necessarily releasing records, but you guys are doing something that's culturally relevant that like changed, you know, what we are doing in terms of like as fans, you know, like if you would have told me like 20 years ago, that I'd be going to a nightclub in Los Angeles with 2,000 people listening to emo music, like getting drunk at a bar, I would have, like with no bands playing, I would have been like, yo, you're crazy.
Oh, you're telling us.
Well, dude, this, I have to delete the next like 3 questions because they are all about what guitar tones you
Tony.
Hold on, let me just go in there and delete.
Oh man.
Yesterday I listened to, I think there are 3 episodes of the I Miss Emo up right now, right?
Yeah, I don't want to say last. That's a bad word. But the 4th episode comes out this Sunday.
Okay, cool. I didn't know what to expect when I listened to it, but it's so cool because the format is that you're interviewing a bunch of different artists about a specific topic, you know, within the emo and pop punk history. And it's so fucking interesting. It's like, I don't know, what made you want to do it in a format like that, as opposed to interviewing one artist and playing some songs?
Yeah, I think I've talked to 20 people so far, 20 different acts over the course of 4 episodes. And it's like, what we found is it's really hard to just, I think the way that we've structured this show is really kind of like a time machine, taking us back to the origins of emo all the way up till now. And like, there's different focus points, obviously. And if you listen to the show, having people on talk, you know, they talk about like first wave, second wave, third wave, you know, this generation, second generation. And so it's been really cool to get everyone's perspective on it all. And it was really hard, like, 20 hours of, you know, one conversation with everyone, like that would be a lot. And there'd be a lot of jumping all over the place. So like kind of taking, like compiling it all, it's kind of like a drive through records compilation, every single episode, you know, like I've had Newfound Glory. I've had Chris from Dashboard Confessional. I've had Mayday Parade. I've had Saves the Day, the Get Up Kids, like all of these iconic, you know, bands that really like shaped not only my like childhood and like my love for the genre, but everyone else's. Mark Hoppus from Blink-182, like got to geek out with him. And
Kevin Lyman
from Warped Tour, you know, and like that was great to catch up with Kevin because like I've known him forever. But it's insane how similar everyone's story about emo is as well. You know, like there's so much that we all have in common about like how we discovered this and, you know, how it kind of came to be. And then there's also like history lessons that like I'm getting, like listening to this, just about like how the scene was when, you know, before I was born and like what people were wearing and like, you know, what other bands they were listening to. And, so yeah, the idea just really came from, wanting to educate people on emo, on how it started and the impact that it's still having on music today. And what's really cool too, is that it has its own playlist now within Apple Music, the I Miss Emo playlist. So like, it's literally all of those bands, like it's like emo essentials, you know, it's like everything.
Yeah.
In one place.
It's also cool. A lot of it is relatable to, you know, different genres of music, because like when Bert from The Used talks about how different shows were before Instagram, how everybody was just there to watch the show and now everyone is just filming everything that they're watching. I think all those things are relatable to anybody, and that's really cool to me.
I just want to take this second that I am one of those dudes that films, but I fucking watch.
He watches it. He like will be sitting on the plane and I look over and Morgan's just like, Morgan is the person that ends up watching those videos back. It's my favorite thing.
It sucks because I saw Saves the Day here and every fucking song I was like, I love this song. I want to watch this, but I want to watch this again. And then I was like, I'll just wait for the next one to watch this. And then he plays a fucking another song where I'm like, God damn it, dude. I love this song. I want to remember this forever. You know, I am that dude, which I never thought I would be that dude. I thought I would be the opposite of that dude. And so I just turned into like some weird emo dad guy.
Yeah. It's honestly so funny because there was a time when you also posted it on your stories. And so I would wake up and look at your Instagram and it was just like the
like 30 dots
show
at the top. Yeah.
Like I didn't even need to go to a show. I could just check out your stories and watch.
I stopped
the whole
doing
thing.
That. I stopped being as social as I was. I found that it's really helped to stay off a little bit and like really limit the amount of time spent on there, especially during this time where we are just by ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the beginning of this year, I deleted all social media off of my phone and just had my friend run mine. And it was great. I still don't have Twitter on my phone.
Yeah. Twitter is a nightmare place.
It's a hellscape for sure.
Yeah.
Which sucks because it's like my favorite app. And it's like I used to get all of my news. Oh. And it's where I've discovered some of my favorite music. You know, like that's literally like where I met Peep. Like I met Peep on Twitter in 2016. And that's how like we became friends. So like, I feel like I'm missing out on certain things, you know, like, cause it's harder. I feel like to like get in early, like on Instagram and others, you know, apps like that. So I do miss Twitter. I contemplate putting it back on my phone like every other day. I'm like, should I download this again? Oh, it's a slippery slope. I've read so many more books though. I want to say I've read so many more books.
What are you reading right now?
I have like 10 books. You know what is really bad is like, I'll read like half a book and then I'll see something else that I want to read and I'll start reading that. I just jump around. So all my books are like dog ears, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I literally have a stack of 6 books I'm looking at right now that I'm reading at once. I just get so excited about another one then I'll start that. And
I do the same thing.
It is. I don't know if it's good or bad. Cause then sometimes I'll be reading a book and I'm like, wait, is that other character in this book? And then it's completely not.
You get confused. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I've been doing a bunch of short stories because I was never a reader. And I was like, what better time to start doing this than now? And I had a bunch of friends drop off short story books because I've got the attention span of a fucking fly. And I've just blown through all of these things that I've wanted to do for a really, really long time, which is just read. Like I wanted to, you know, I was always really envious of people posting pictures of like what they were reading. Cause I was like, how do you fucking sit down for that long by yourself and let your brain just do this thing? My brain just didn't work that way. And it almost took practice to get me to start reading.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And like, that's how, in the morning I used to wake up and just scroll Twitter. And so instead I just started reading a book. And
that's sick. I love that. Been good. Love that journey for you. All right, we gotta jump on another Zoom. I can't believe it's been an hour. That's crazy.
That flew by, to be honest.
It really did.
But that's how you know it was good. I know.
Yeah. Maybe we just still do this once a week.
We still we have start like a podcast the three questions.
I know, there's like so many. Maybe we'll do a part two at some point.
I'm super down. Let's do it.
Sick.
Maybe we could do it around the record.
Yeah, totally down. Cool. All right. Well, have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, you guys as well. I hope the next one goes amazing.
Thank you for taking the time, dude. It's so good to talk to you for 2 days in a row.
I know. I'm going to miss you guys tomorrow. I might just call and say hi.
Anytime.
All right. Well, be sure to ask them about guitar tones, Morgan, on the next one. All right. I want that to be the opening question.
Yeah, on like a on an album that has no guitar.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right, brother.
Bye. All right, guys. Have a good day. Bye.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Ever heard of stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of stoicism with a lowercase s and not stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference. All that is stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.